country's sovereignty. This after President Macron said the Amazon wildfires should be at the top of the G7 summit agenda. Bolsonaro responded, his government is open to dialogue, but the French president's suggestion that Amazonian issues be discussed without the participation of the countries of the region evokes a misplaced colonialist mindset. Dr. Doug Morton, a NASA scientist, explains how deforestation has played a role.
This is really the second part of the story that began with our observations of an increase in deforestation. That deforestation only proceeds to someone being able to use those areas for agriculture if those areas are burned.
Thousands of wildfires burning in the Amazon rainforest threaten to wipe out large parts of the ecosystem. I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If we don't act now rather than tomorrow, we cannot help those children to have access to education, which is a fundamental human right.
That's UNICEF's goodwill ambassador on how closure of schools due to attacks and threats are affecting children in Central and West Africa. Details coming up also. Another journalist has been arrested in Tanzania in what government critics are calling a crackdown on media. And cases of rape in Nigeria are on the increase at a very alarming rate. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN Children's Fund reports conflict is robbing nearly 2 million children across 8 countries in West and Central Africa of an education and a viable future. A new UNICEF report warns this will have negative consequences for countries that need an educated workforce to rebuild their shattered economies. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The UN Children's Agency reports schools across West and Central Africa are being deliberately targeted by insurgent groups. It says an upsurge in attacks and threats of violence have forced more than 9,000 schools in the region to close since the end of 2017. UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador Muzun Al-Malayan, who has just returned from a visit to Mali, describes the suffering of the children she met as living in fear of their lives and their futures.
Many schools have been attacked, and which resulted many children out of school, which affects the future of those countries. And if we don't act now, rather than tomorrow, we cannot help those children to have access to education, which is a fundamental human right.
Al-Malayan is passionate about her mission. She is a Syrian refugee who was forced to flee her war-torn country in 2013. She spent several years in a refugee camp. Life in the camp was not easy, but she says she was able to get an education. She says this gave her hope and had a positive impact on her life. She says she wants other children in dire circumstances to have the same opportunities she has had. She tells VOA that children who have no education are vulnerable to abuse, manipulation, and exploitation.
Sometimes they are exploited sexually, or maybe they get married at such a young age. Maybe they will be also in child labor, and most dangerously when they can go for recruitment by those terrorist groups. So those terrorist groups can exploit them, can use them as child soldiers, and this can destroy their future and their lives.
UNICEF is working with authorities and communities to support alternative learning opportunities. These include community learning centers, radio school programs, and faith-based learning initiatives. The agency has appealed for $221 million to pay for educational, psychosocial support and care for school children and other essential programs in the region. It has received less than 30% of that amount. It is appealing to donors to answer its call for support in providing millions of African children with an education and a future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Another journalist has been arrested in Tanzania in what government critics are calling a crackdown on media. The arrest of Joseph Gandhi came Thursday after he reported that police allegedly tortured detainees in the central Iringa region. He reports for Watetezi Television, according to the Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition, which owns the online channel. The group says Gandhi is accused of publishing false information. Another Tanzanian journalist, Eric Kabandera, was detained less than a month ago and has been charged with organized crime and financial offenses. Reporters Without Borders has called President John Magufuli a press freedom predator and dropped Tanzania 25 places on its annual Press Freedom Index this year. Magufuli has shut down newspapers, banned opposition rallies, switched off live broadcasts of parliamentary sessions, and used the cybercrimes law to jail critics. As terror groups in southern and central Africa commit deadly attacks and pledge allegiance to the Islamic State, experts are trying to determine how big a threat they pose to the region and the wider world. VOA Salem Salamon has the story.
Experts are warning that a focus on alleged Islamist militant ties is hindering efforts to respond to insurgencies in Mozambique and the Democratic Republic of Congo. On April 18, a strike on an army base near the Congo's border with Uganda left several Congolese soldiers dead and others injured. It was the first attack credited to Wilayat Central Africa, previously known as the Allied Democratic Forces, a group that has pledged allegiance to IS. A month later, an IS group took responsibility for attacks in northern Mozambique, part of a growing insurgency in the country led by several groups, including Ahlusuna Wajama and Al-Shabaab.
There's a lot of opacity around this. We don't know exactly who these guys are, but they clearly have an Islamist bent, but they're also in bed with some of the organized crime networks up there. That's how they get some of their revenues, and they may even have some networks across the borders. Borders very porous in that part of Mozambique.
That's Joshua Mazervi, a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. He says the group shares its name, but there's no known connection with the Somali terrorist organization Al-Shabaab. On July 24, IS released a video featuring a man named Sheikh Abu Abdul Rahman, who called for an end to division and fighting among Muslims in Central Africa. He also called for the creation of a caliphate. The video features heavily armed fighters in a forested area pledging allegiance to IS. But experts are unsure whether links to IS signal a new threat or simply reflect the group's attempt to raise their profile. Ryan O'Farrell, an extremism researcher at Johns Hopkins University, said experts have found virtually no evidence that IS has trained, funded, or equipped its African affiliates.
It also doesn't necessarily fit Islamic State's model. You know, they have affiliates all over the continent, and most of them haven't received training or weapons from Islamic State Central. Pretty much all of its affiliates are local groups that have local recruitment networks and local financial capacity and local weapons procurement channels. So they affiliate themselves with Islamic State as a brand, but the real tangible connections are quite rarely there.
Nearly daily attacks in the Cabo Delgado region have made the insurgency in Mozambique one of Africa's deadliest. The group in the DRC has pulled off high-profile attacks, killing UN peacekeepers, O'Farrell added.
Their targets are primarily local. It's fairly rarely the MO for some of the more peripheral Islamic State affiliates. But within those zones, so within Beni territory in North Kivu and within Cabo Delgado in northern Mozambique, they're very active.
Yusuf Adam, an associate professor in Maputo, Mozambique, said rather than receiving arms or provisions from IS, insurgent groups in Mozambique are capturing them from the Mozambican armed forces.
Practically, there are attacks every day. They kill two police persons here, three persons there. They take guns and ammunition and so on. And it seems that they feed themselves feed their operations from guns they collect.
The insurgency in Mozambique is hard to understand because they have not made any public pronouncements. They are decentralized and likely include former street hawkers with links to organized crime. Jad Devremont, director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said the insurgency in Mozambique may have Islamist roots, but other factors fuel it.
This is what I would call an insipid insurgency. That's important because it means that there are opportunities here in the embryonic stage to address its concerns, snuff it out, and bring back some of these individuals as part of society.
Oil and gas companies hiring locals who might otherwise become frustrated and join the insurgency would help a lot, Devremont said. Adam believes the insurgency cannot be addressed by looking at it internationally. Instead, he urged policymakers to look at the local grievances of northern Mozambique, which has long been cut off from the economic hubs of the country and underserved by the central government.
Violence breeds violence. And in fact, what we need is to start working readily to see what are the problems, what is in the political economy of northern Mozambique.
Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Fifteen past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. At least 130 Nigerian refugees who fled the Boko Haram insurgency in Cameroon have been flown to Yola in Nigeria's Adamawa state. They expressed hope they will find peace after several years of atrocities that made them escape Nigeria. It's the first phase of a voluntary repatriation exercise organized by Cameroon, Nigeria, and the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kenzeka watched as they left and has this report for VOA.
The engine of a Nigerian Air Force flight rumbles at the Marwa Salak International Airport as 133 refugees from 25 families head to the town of Yola. Among them is 31-year-old Alim Bukadia, who says he is anxious to return after 4 years in Cameroon.
We say thank God to Cameroon that helped to keep us in their country. And then today, our country needs us, thank Cameroon and HCR that help us.
Bukadia is one of 110,000 Nigerians whom the United Nations says fled to Cameroon from Boko Haram-related violence in Nigeria. He left Cameroon's Minawawo refugee camp that is home to nearly 90,000 people. At least 30,000 additional refugees have been living in villages surrounding the camp. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has not said how many have voluntarily agreed to return. Sadiya Umar Farouk, Nigeria's Minister of Humanitarian Affairs, Disaster Management and Social Development, says the refugees are leaving following a March 2017 tripartite agreement for the voluntary repatriation of Nigerian refugees living in Cameroon. Cameroon, Nigeria and UNHCR signed the deal. Farouk says they have made necessary arrangements for their socioeconomic reinsertion into Nigeria.
We're going to put them in a reception center for a maximum of 7 days, after which they will be taken back to their respective communities. And we're going to support them with skills, with empowerment, so that they can be back on their feet, they can be economically self-reliant.
Midjiyawa Bakari, governor of Cameroon's far north region that shares a border with Nigeria, says many of the refugees want to return, but are reluctant because airlifting them with the animals they have been keeping in Cameroon is difficult.
Many refugees have luggage, have cows, but it's difficult to go back by air. And that's why some of them are still thinking that it is necessary to see way of means to enable them to go back with all they gather here without any problem.
Midjiyawa Bakari said Cameroon's government will let them go with their livestock by road when they are sure of their security. Last week, Cameroonian authorities warned that Boko Haram may be planning raids that could affect school children and their teachers when the academic year begins on September 3. officials have begun giving huge consignments of food, money, and equipment to militias on the northern border with Nigeria, defending areas from which the military has withdrawn. The United Nations reports that the 10-year Boko Haram violence has displaced over 2.7 million people, including some 210,000 Nigerian refugees, into neighboring countries. The insurgent group promotes an extreme form of Islamist fundamentalism and opposes Western-style education. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Marwa, Cameroon.
Liberian President George Weah wants to reduce term limits for president, representatives, and senators. Moses Garzo reports from Monrovia.
President George Weah assembled dozens of legislators over the weekend, urged them to cut their years elected officials serve. Weah asked for a constitutional change to reduce the term of the president from 6 years to 5 years. He also wants representatives to serve 5 years instead of six, and senators to sit for 7 years instead of nine. Deputy Presidential Press Secretary Smith Tobe says the president intends is to push officials to begin serving the people from the day they assume office. Tobe says often elected officials neglect their duties and only begin actually working at the close of their terms, which he says hamper development.
For example, a senator will perhaps wait for the last 2 years of his 9 years to start to take development to his county. That is not fair in terms of representation. Some lawmakers tend to be complacent. They got 6 years, they could start working in the last 3 years of their administration. That is also not being fair to the electorates. The president, sometimes 6 years, and they start to work maybe in the last 2 years. If you start to work immediately upon your election as of day one, know that you got 5 years, you would have to take some time to play it around. And I think that once that is passed, it gives extra burden and attention to those who will be elected to those positions. They will start to work immediately upon their election.
Some legislators who attended the meeting praised the president for coming out to explain his intent on some of the legislations he wants them to pass. Representative Richard Nagbe-Kun thinks it's the perfect way to understand the laws they are to deliberate on.
We embrace the idea. I would say it was first of its kind since the president took over, to have this kind of coordinated and very reconciled retreat, because we all interacted, we revised our things that we're not satisfied with. And I think he looked in that direction to see how best we can work together instead of one group of government strangling the other branch of government.
Representative Francis Dopo from Rewaji County thinks the best way to solve some of Liberia's major issues is to rewrite the constitution.
Some people could vote for the proposition from the point of anger, from the point of political oppositionness, from the point of political favoritism. You know, so as a lawmaker, I just think that the people view matter. But I can tell you the best thing to do is to rewrite the constitution.
But his colleague Vincent Willie of Grand Bassa County said rewriting the constitution would take time and resources.
Rewriting the constitution is very much germane. It is important. But given the time interval, you cannot rewrite your constitution for just 6 months. You're talking about a whole year. It's a process. It's not even. So I think by changing some of the proposition and making sure that at least the law is relaxed and flexible, the next step will be reviewing or rewriting the entire constitution.
This is not the first time the idea of cutting terms has come up. A constitutional review committee under former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf made similar recommendation after doing a nationwide consultation, but their recommendations went nowhere. We are also used the gathering to unveil 25 proposed bills, most of which concerns constitutional amendments. For instance, he is asking for a change to allow Liberians to hold dual citizenship. Moses Gazel, VOA News, Monrovia.
Cases of rape in Nigeria are on the increase at a very alarming rate among women, young girls, and even infants. According to a report by UNICEF in 2015, one in four girls and one in 10 boys in Nigeria had experienced sexual violence before the age of 18.
The majority of the cases went unreported in the past, probably because of the stigma society associates with the act. But in the last couple of years, victims of sexual violence have been stepping forward to narrate their ordeals. Reporter Gift Agriga visited the Salama Sexual Assault Referral Center in Guamana Awan General Hospital in Kaduna State to look at the disturbing trend.
Three survivors who preferred to remain anonymous told VOA about their experiences. They spoke in the Hausa language and Pidgin English. A three-year-old girl who was under the care of her grandmother was allegedly raped twice by a 44-year-old neighbor. The grandmother narrated what happened. She says she was reluctant to report it to the police because she believed she would not get justice, and being a poor widow, no one would believe her. It was on a second attempt that she ran to the Salama Center and received help. The second survivor, in her late 30s, says, she was kidnapped in her home while sleeping with her husband and child. She says her doctors made her walk through the night in thick forests. Later, the three of them took turns raping her every morning and evening until ransom was paid and they freed her. A 10-year-old girl who is the third survivor was reportedly raped by a 29-year-old man who lives in her neighborhood. She says she was lured to a corner by the perpetrator in the pretense that he wanted her to run an errand. The man stuffed her hijab in her mouth and raped her outside their compound. Juliana Joseph is the manager of the Salama Sexual Assault Referral Center. She says 90% of the victims are being sexually abused by people they know.
We've had grandparents raping their biological granddaughters. We've had fathers raping their biological daughters. We've had uncles raping their nieces and their nephews. We have trusted neighbors. You are going out and you entrust your children in the care of your neighbor, and by the time you are back, it is a different story.
A good number of the perpetrators of rape move about freely due to poor investigations. Barrister Zainab Aminu Garuba, chairperson of the International Federation of Women Lawyers, FIDA, in Kaduna, says rape has become an epidemic in the Northwest.
Rape is not just a phenomenon that is only known to be happening to only the women folk. It's happening to men too. Underage boys being defiled, several cases being reported to us. It is very worrisome. It is an epidemic, and I pray and hope that the government will see it as such and will do something very, very fast.
Yakubu Sabo, the police public relations officer in Kaduna State Command, said so many rape cases involving children go uninvestigated because parents want to protect their children from stigmatization.
Some families kill the evidence by sticking to that belief system that don't expose our child to the public that she had been raped, because at later stage she may not get a suitor to marry, or because of stigma attached to her. So this kind of perception or belief dampen the spirit for families to seek redress when their child is involved in cases of rape.
Sabo advised parents to be watchful in their neighborhood and be mindful of who they leave their children with. The Nigerian Criminal Code recommends life imprisonment for rape convicts and 14 years imprisonment for attempted rape. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC.